impact on people and communities of color and unfairly block many qualified people from employment. Help end this practice by speaking up. If you or someone you know has been turned down for a job or even fired from a job because of credit checks by an employer, please call NIDAS Financial Justice Hotline at 212-925-4929.
And it's midnight here at WBAI New York and around the tri-state area, too, I reckon. Time now for Night Shift with Mike Sargent and the gang.
And you're tuned to listener-sponsored radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York, and this is Night Shift.
Mike Sargent.
So, first of all, we're going to talk about a few movies and whatnot. And there are a few things. You have some Life is Like Science Fiction, some things in the news and whatnot. But let's just talk about a couple movies that have just recently come out. We're definitely going to talk about Life, and I want to talk to you about Fantastic Beasts and Get Out. And I went to a Valerian event today and got to meet Luc Besson and Dane DeHaan. But you also have an interview, and so do I. So we've got a lot here on the show.
We have much. It's like a vegetable and meat pizza all in one.
That's right, like a smorgasbord. Yeah. And so stay tuned.
We'll be right back.
All right, so Joe, first, let me get your thoughts on the new movie Life.
I thought, and it was something that we agreed upon, that as I was sitting there, I pictured the pitch session where the guys who were pitching this to the studio said, imagine Alien meets
Gravity. Exactly. 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 Listen, listen. Like, you know that was the pitch. You know that was the pitch. As soon as you hear it, as soon as you see it, you're like, ah.
Exactly.
So, all right.
So, and the special, you know, the visual effects for Outer Space, the space station, although the space station, when you see it in space and it's this vast, you know, space station, and when you think about the current International Space Station orbiting and all the different, you know, units that are part of that, it just seemed like while you viewed it outside and it was this great, you know, massive jumble of components, when it came down to the actual action and movement inside, there were only like 3 to 4 locations and just lots and lots of long floating corridors for them to have chase sequences in.
Well,
you know,
I thought the production design actually was good. I liked that.
Yeah.
I liked that, you know, if we're just from a completely production design standpoint, I liked how some of the equipment looked like as old as it is on up there, 25, 35 years old. And there's no reason to ever repaint, you know, the space station. So it's got that been touched by, you know, 25, 30 years of scientists look to it. So I liked a lot of things about it. I did like, but go ahead. I want to hear the rest of your review.
And, you know, the initial creature design, it was funny when it first took form and it was that little, bulb on the end of a stalk. I'm thinking, oh, that's the Audrey 2 from Little Shop of Horrors.
Ah, somebody else said that, yes.
And then it turns into another creature that you've seen someplace else. And when it was fully matured, I thought it was a hybrid of the alien creature meets the more kinder aliens from James Cameron's Abyss. But when it shows its face, it's this like really like cut-up looking spike gremlin from the movie Gremlins.
Ah, that's so funny. You're the first, for a second, the mystery guest said it looked like a gremlin. Well, you know, I agree. I think the creature in some ways was the weakest part in that, you know, it just looked like a CGI creature, you know. It looked, that's what it looked like. It didn't really give the organic feel that it started out with. It started out looking very organic and less, you know, digital, as it were. You know, I thought they went out of their way to try and create some characters, you know, that we haven't seen in every science fiction film. And I thought they went out of their way to have some imaginative sci-fi deaths. And so there were definitely some horrific deaths in there. But it definitely, you know, it can't help but be as derivative as it is. And there are definitely some, you know, leaps of logic, in my opinion, in terms of plot, that you go, what, you know, what? So that's my thought. What, do you agree with that?
No, I do. And what's really interesting is I took a look at the PR that they were doing for the movie, and there was a point where they did all these interviews with these genetic biologists and scientists with different areas of expertise that they did these little Q&A sessions with about the movie and what they contributed to it. And when, if you do sit through the credits, you'll see that there are a lot of people, scientists and engineers who've contributed to the film. But even for all that, the minutiae that's supporting the narrative, it doesn't feel as intelligent as it should. You know what I mean?
Well, you see, that's the thing. I felt that at its root, the 10 little Indians in space is always going to be compared to Alien, and it has become a sci-fi / horror convention. That being said, you know, that's what the plot is. So no matter how much science you wrap into the creature, that's essentially what the movie is. So I felt, like you said, it's sort of like, okay, all that quote-unquote support
for the creature and its biological function, and the as Hitchcock would say, the MacGuffin of the film, which is the villain or the you know the antagonist. You didn't come away. I wasn't like impressed. I mean, it started out interesting, and they said a lot of science stuff that sounded real. But then ultimately, it's got to start killing people, and all the science stuff kind of goes away.
And at the end of the day, you know what the funny thing is about it? When you think about Alien, they were called to the planet, they were looking for stuff, they interacted with it, they didn't antagonize anything. In this movie, when the creature like grows and then it goes into like a stasis kind of thing, they shock the hell out of it to try to get it a reaction. And what do you think it's going to do?
Well, you know, actually, some of that stuff I kind of believed. I mean, it was a little dramatic, but I mean, there were a few leaps of logic, like, oh, I'm tired, and now I've endangered the whole crew. That was a little bit of a, like, okay, you know. And their, let's just say, initially their affection for it, you know,
Exactly. That's what I said. Yeah.
You know. So overall, I thought Life was okay. It's worth seeing. But it's definitely, you know, it is what it is.
It's a greasy popcorn movie, and if you can see it at a bargain matinee, it's a bargain.
It's a bargain. Now that's a bargain.
There you go.
Now, all right, we'll talk about two things. Something that I didn't see that you saw, something that you saw that I didn't see. You saw the movie before we get to the interview with Prevenge, but of the two films that you saw that I didn't see, Dig Two Graves and The Transfiguration, which do you feel is the more superior film that you want to speak of?
I think first of all, they're two very different films.
Yes.
Dig Two Graves is actually a period piece because it goes between 1947 and 1977. And it's a thriller with some psychological and supernatural overtones, which are basically left up to the viewer to discern. And I asked a question of the director about that. But as far as Transfiguration, in reading the synopsis for it, I had thought that there was going to be this character arc. So it said that there's an event that this character experiences, and because of that, he starts identifying with this vampire. And so I thought there was going to be this whole progression and stuff. But no, I mean, when the movie starts, you jump into it. This young African-American boy thinks that he is a vampire, and he is draining somebody in the bathroom at Penn Station. So that's how the movie starts. And it's this really interesting character study that's set up against the projects of New York and some of the gangs and things that go on there. And this kid dealing with a brother who's come back from the war, who is very dysfunctional, and him dealing with the death of their mother, and then, you know, what's happening to this kid, and how he starts to start questioning evil and what evil is. And, you know, it was really interesting. It's a little slow and methodical. But you can't help once you if you get hooked by the kid, then you can't help but wonder where they're going with it. And what makes it very slow and methodical is that the kid, the young adult actor, doesn't talk that much. So a lot of stuff is revealed through his drawings, through his actions, through a lot of him interacting with his environment. So it's slow in that respect because there's not a lot of dialogue with that going on, but, and his journals. So I found it in some ways very powerful. I found it really poignant as a metaphor of, you know, what this kid experienced, and given the environment that he was in, that he could have turned toward like gang violence or been a gangbanger because of the neighborhood he lived in. But yet, because he is a little bit more literary based before the tragedy happens, he hooks onto this vampire mythos, and it's really different. And, you know, I know a lot of people would see it, might be put off because it is a little slow and a little dark and whatever, but I think it's a very powerful story, and I think it's very well made and very well thought out.
Okay. Okay, that sounds like a major endorsement from Joe Massiri. It's like a major endorsement. All right, so... all right, well, there are a few things that I'm going to play, and you have something to play, but I'll give my review of the Boss Baby, you know, in case you're wondering.
Yeah, please.
All right, now here's the first of all, if you know the premise, it's about this Boss Baby, about this new baby arrives to this family, and you know, it's a Boss Baby, it's a certain kind of baby, and we set up this whole baby world, like where babies come from, and certain kinds of babies. There's regular babies that have become just part of the family, then they're the Boss Babies who have a mission, and they're there to help protect the love of babies, and protect the love of babies, and the love of babies being threatened by an ex-Baby Corps agent, okay, who has turned rogue and is now perpetrating a something to take away the love from babies, which is a kitten that lives forever. Okay, that's the basic premise of the film. Now, I give all of that because none of that really matters. It, you know, it's what should matter is the fun of it, and it never really goes beyond mildly amusing. I have to wonder what a child would think, because lots of the quote unquote jokes in there are, you know, more adults would get them, and you never really get more than a chuckle, really. You know, there are a few laughs throughout the film, but the animation is uninspiring. The character design is uninspiring. The humor is, you know, marginal, in my opinion. It's got all this great talent. Alec Baldwin does a great job, I gotta say. Steve Buscemi does a voice, Lisa Kudrow, Jimmy Kimmel, like all these really talented people do voice work in this film. And it is inventive. There are some flourishes of creativity, but the bar has been set much, much, much higher by Pixar and even what Disney's been putting out since John Lasseter took over. And I can't say anything more than mostly harmless. So,
yeah, but you know, the other thing too is this is from DreamWorks Studio, and sure. DreamWorks, you know, has, even though they haven't done some of the great artistic stuff with their shorts that Disney and Pixar have done, there's been a level there, and from what you're saying, it sounds like it's not even matching the standards set by Blue Sky Studios and DreamWorks.
Well, like, tell me what you consider to be one of their best two films.
Well, you know, Blue Skies did the Peanuts movie.
Well, they did Ice Age before that.
And they did Ice Age, and the first couple Ice Age films were a lot of fun and well-written and stuff.
Okay. Well, you know, here's the thing. I think that this is, it's consistently amusing, consistently inventive, but it never reaches any real peak. The flourishes that I'm talking about kind of show you there was some potential to this concept there. And you know, it definitely does its thing to pull at your heartstrings, and there's enough story there for you to not be bored, but I can't say it's a classic.
Gotcha.
You know, and you know, but I will say also that, you know, in many ways, because animated films have become so really so good, that something that would have been considered, hey, that's pretty good, it's become mediocre, don't you think?
if it's not done well, and the other thing too is if it's an IMAX
3D. There's a lot of really good animated films out there now.
But and if it's an IMAX 3D movie and you're going to take the family to see it, is it well worth shelling out $25 per person for? So for a family of four, you're looking at $100 just to walk in the door.
Well, I don't know. I don't know if this is IMAX 3D, but you know,
it is in 3D.
Is it in 3D? I think, yeah. I saw it in 3D. I mean, the 3D, you know, here's the thing. Animated films always work best in 3D because they use the most of the 3D. But I'm not judging it for the use of 3D. I'm judging it for how it is as family entertainment. As family entertainment, it's fine. You know, there are definitely some, most of the jokes are more adult jokes, I think, than kid jokes in terms of what will make you laugh. You know, I went with some kids, so they enjoyed it. So what do I know?
There you go. We're nothing but old farts. What do we know?
All right, now tell me about the one you were giving away tickets to free tickets to pregnant women. Explain that whole scam, Joe, and what this movie and the interview were about to hear.
All right. So while I was at AFM, I picked a movie, my schedule, and there was this movie called Prevenge. Prevenge is written, directed, and stars Alice Lowe. And Alice Lowe, you've seen her on a bunch of different things. She's been on Doctor Who. She's been on a bunch of BBC shows. And she's just a versatile actress. And Prevenge is about a woman who loses her husband. And she finds out that she's pregnant. And she's dealing now with all the pitfalls and the trials and tribulations of trying to be a woman who's, you know, pregnant and alone in dealing with society. And she starts hearing the voice of her fetus, who's telling her in certain situations, like when she goes for this job interview, that is she going to take that this person really needs to be killed, kind of thing. So her unborn fetus drives her to commit murder.
And you interviewed this woman?
Yes, I did.
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
And the funny thing was, which I didn't know, which comes out in the course of the interview, is that she was, the scenes where she's pregnant, she's actually pregnant. She was pregnant when she wrote the film, directed the film, starred in the film, and even while she was editing the film. So,
oh, dude, let's go to the tape. Let's go to the tape.
I'm really sorry about your loss, and I know it's been very difficult for you. At the end of the day, you've got this force of nature now inside you. Baby knows what to do. Baby will tell you what to do. It's just nature's way.
I think nature's a bit of an arse, though, don't you?
You're getting better at this.
I'm not in control. Don't want to know what's in there. I'm scared of her. I would swap her to have him, fuck. She can't hear you. She can't. She's very articulate.
Kill him, or I kill you.
Do you want a drink?
If it's fun, you're after. You've come to the right place.
I'm on the dark side. You would not believe what I've been doing recently.
Oh!
Very efficient with that one.
I was wondering if I could talk to you about child charity.
You're insane. I am a working mother.
Children these days are really spoiled. Like, Mummy, I want a PlayStation. Mummy, I want you to kill that man.
Of my voice.
Baby knows best.
You're a real bad girl.
Negativity's not good for the baby's spirit, really. Do you think?
And this is Joe Massiri. At this year's AFM, on my schedule was a film called Prevenge,
which I wanted to see and was compelled to sit there to the very end. It's a thrilling film with some satire, with some horror, with some real life drama. And it is written, directed, and stars Alice Lowe. And I am pleased to be joined with her today. How are you, Alice?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Very good, thank you. Just so you know, and I can be honest with you, when I was at AFM, I had a rule because I had so many films that I wanted to see for a film festival that I work with, that I put 40 minutes on my smartphone, and when the 40 minutes were up, I would jump into another screening. But yours was one of the few that I was compelled to sit there to the very end to see where you were going with it. So it's
amazing.
It is an amazing independent film. And
that's a good compliment.
I have to ask, there's so many different things going on in the plot, but what was the initial core idea that got you so excited about this script that you eventually directed in and starred in, and is your, if I am correct, your feature film debut?
I mean, it was a strange process because I was actually pregnant and someone came to me and said, look, there's some finance available for you to make a feature. It could be whatever you want. And I was sort of frustrated that this was happening to me now because I had wanted to direct a film for a while or make another film, and it just wasn't happening for me. And I actually turned it down, and then I kind of went away and thought, well, I would like to be working, really, because it's scary being a freelancer and having a baby, really. And so I came up with this idea, and I'd long thought about Taxi Driver, about why there weren't more female maverick loner outsider characters. And so I kind of paired that together with pregnancy and all the things that I was actually going through, and some of the discomfort and strangeness and existential crisis that I felt like I was going through. And I just put those two ideas together, and that character kind of sprang to life. Yeah, before I knew it, I was writing the script, and we shot it within 2 months, basically, of me coming up with the idea.
The script for 2 months coming up with the idea, that's amazing. When I interview a lot of directors and we talk about genre films, and I wouldn't say that this is specifically a horror film, while it does have some horror tropes, when I talk to the directors, one of the things I mention is that every great filmmaker has a horror film in their bio. And I think that's because when you're starting out, a horror film runs the full gamut of all the emotions and everything that you can do in a film. So if you really want to create something that's a really good showcase for your talent, that a horror film is the way to go.
I mean, I absolutely agree. I'm often asked about why there's so many female horror directors coming out at the moment. And I'm a bit like, I think it's just a sign that there's female directors emerging, because most successful directors have got a horror early on in their career. And I completely agree. I think it's a way of making cinematic the kind of heights of human emotion that we go through. I mean, I really like Black Swan, for example. I actually think that is a horror, but it's not spoken of as being horror, actually. But I think it's a classic horror. It's someone going through, descending into the pit of madness, and it's being shown metaphorically, basically. And I think that's all that horror is. You know, werewolves are a metaphor, vampires are a metaphor. I certainly felt like pregnancy was a metaphor within this film, and you know, I just wanted to make sure that was rendered cinematically and in a funny sort of way. Instead of there being loads of violence about giving birth, it's like the violence turned out onto the victims, basically. And you know, a lot of the psychological stuff she's going through is transposed onto this fetus that's living within her.
You know, it's interesting because having been a father twice over, I understand the mental process and how it changes during the different trimesters of pregnancy. And you were actually pregnant during the making of this movie?
Yeah, so I was 6 months pregnant when I wrote it, and by the time we finished filming it, I was 8 and a bit months pregnant.
Wow.
So I kind of agreed to do it in the sort of heights of second trimester euphoria, which I think some women have to a greater or lesser extent. I was like prolific. I was like, had a really bad first trimester where I was just sleeping all the time, and I felt like I was jet-lagged, and I was like, this is awful. Like, how do people earn money when they feel like this, you know? So I couldn't really work, and then by the time I got to my second trimester, I was like, right, I feel amazing. What can I say yes to? I'm just going to say yes to everything, because I need money, and I need the work, and I don't know when I'll be able to do it again. And so I kind of, like, wrote some short horror stories for an anthology. I went to Edinburgh and was in an Edinburgh show for three nights, you know. I did some radio stuff that was live, and then I agreed to do a feature film. So it's kind of like, yeah, people don't talk about that phase of pregnancy much. By the time we filmed it, actually, I mean, for me personally, it was quite good to be on my feet. I think certainly psychologically for me to be busy, for me it was great. I had an amazing time. I was like, oh, I thought I'd have to give up my career and that I was going to be really sad about that. Actually, here I am, I'm filming, I'm with colleagues, I'm with friends, I'm talking about film, I'm doing what I love, I'm doing what I'm good at. And I just felt incredibly smug, like I was having my cake and eating it, really. So there was no downside of shooting to me. I think the bigger challenge has much more been like post-production with a small baby. And actually promoting the film with a small baby as well has been a whole other challenge.
So between when you wrote the script and you actually finished editing it, did the narrative really change that much? Did being you're the writer, director, and the lead actor, did it go through any phases of change that were notable during the process?
I don't think so. I think really I had a bit of an epiphany that I wasn't trying to tell every woman's story or every human being's story or every pregnant woman's story. I really was like, this is just a personal journey and it's a very idiosyncratic film. And that was kind of an epiphany to me. I kind of have this belief and it was reinforced by the editing process that you can't make a film that's different to what you shot. What you shot, the film is contained in the raw footage that you have. And it's about excavating it. It's like almost like finding the grain within the wood and going with it, or sort of having a rough diamond that you're trying to make into a beautiful necklace. And you kind of have to go with what the beauty is that's contained within it. So it's like, you know, we reached a point in the edit where it was like, what is this again? What is the film? What are we trying to do with it? And I think that's completely normal as well in the edit of a film. And you show it to some people and, you know, the exec was like, oh, it's not as funny as I thought it was going to be. And I was like, well, that is in the script. There's whole chunks of it that where there's no jokes, you know, it's serious. He was like, oh yeah, but you know, maybe we should put more jokes in. And I thought about that for a bit, and then I was like, you can't put more jokes in where there aren't more jokes. That would be a mistake to kind of try and make it what it's not, you know. And I just sort of had this epiphany, like, it can only be the best version of what you've shot. And really, you have to just make sure that each scene is interesting. That's the most important thing. And don't underestimate your audience to kind of think, oh no, they only like funny stuff or they only like horror. It's like, you're just telling a story and you shouldn't have any presuppositions about what the audience's expectations are, because really, as long as it's good, they'll like it. That's what I think anyway. And that's been kind of borne out, and I'm really glad that I followed my intuition with it and my instincts, because I think there's been lots of work that I've done in the past where I've had much more feedback or much more other people telling me what to do, and when I followed that, it's not been good. So really, I was lucky. I was working with a production company that gave me such freedom. Really, they were like, whatever you want to do, we'll stick by you, you know, we'll help you if you want us to. But really, at the end of the day, it was kind of me and the editor kind of talking about the film and going, just needs to be the best version of the film that it can be. And that was, you know, that was kind of like quite a magical privilege to not have lots of people sticking their head in the door going, no, it has to be a 15 certificate. Sorry, I've got a squealing baby. She agrees with me about 15 certificate. Yeah, I'm sort of aware that that's not very common for that to happen with films, for people to just leave you alone and let you make the film you want to make. But I'm really grateful for that, and I'm sort of like, now it's just the challenge of like trying to maintain that with other films that I make, and trying to listen to intuition instead of like trying to second guess what the audience wants.
You've got a very big resume, and it runs the gamut of a lot of different genres. So when you see yourself returning to the director's chair again and the writing chair again, is horror a genre you're comfortable working in? Or, as I mentioned, this is the one for your resume, and is really other things you're passionate about?
I mean, I do really love horror, and my next project is still dark, but it's kind of more conceptual and surreal, and so it's kind of building on the skill set that I have and the way that I've learned to work, but kind of going even further and sort of hoping that the audience are going to come with me, basically. Yeah, I sort of think I'm more of a fantasy writer in some ways than a horror writer, because my comedy, I like surreal comedy, I like fantasy, I'd love to make a sci-fi, you know. To me, they're kind of horror, you know, they're all things that are under that same umbrella of fantasy. Because, I mean, as you say, this is not conventional horror. To me, it's like all films are dreams, and I'm kind of interested how you can push visual metaphors so that you're kind of giving the audience the ultimate kind of dream experience, really, that you're kind of seeing stuff that you don't see in real life. You know, I love the way that Coen brothers, they can make whatever film they like, but it's always operating within the same universe, whether it's a horror or a comedy or a western or whatever. It sort of belongs to the same universe. So that's really what I would like to do, I think.
Again, we've been talking with Alice Lowe, the writer, director, and actor of Prevenge, and her daughter Della in the background, adding some commentary to her mother's comments. So, Alice, it's been a real pleasure. The film was a great film. I've enjoyed your career in a lot of the films that you've been in, and we welcome you back when you have your next project finished, and Della as well.
Oh, amazing. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Cheers.
The music that you've been listening to in the background is by James Griffith, one of the composers on the film, and former member of Lake Trout.
All right, Alice Lowe. So this is in theaters right now?
This is in theaters and on demand right now.
On demand too?
Yes.
All right, so, Prevenge. Just revenge with a P.
Yes, pregnant revenge. Prevenge.
Pregnant revenge. All right, well, I have an interview. I started to play last week, and I had a problem with the actual tape of it, the CD. So now I'm going to play my interview with Dan Klaus, who's got a film out called Wilson, which is based on the graphic novel that he created. And it's let's just say about a guy who's socially challenged, who then faces a number of life challenges himself, including the fact that he finds out that he has a daughter he never knew existed. I get a chance to interview Dan, because we go way back, about what it took, you know, to adapt, you know, a graphic novel to screen, because graphic novels are a very different medium and works a very different way. So we talked about that. So this is Dan Klaus talking about the film that just came out past Friday, Wilson, starring Woody Harrelson, Laura Dern. Take a listen. All right, I'm here with Dan Klaus, who is the screenwriter and creator of a character called Wilson. Dan, welcome to WBAI again.
Hey, nice to see you, sir.
All right, so considering I know you better than most people, and we go back to...
Way too far,
to embarrassing moments. But my first question to you, and I realize I never asked you this, when did you first know you wanted to be a storyteller?
I think when I first met you back in the old days, I wanted to draw comics, and I was looking for somebody to write the comics for me. I thought, I'm not a writer, I'm a drawer. And I looked all around. I asked everybody I knew in New York, can you write me stories? I had all these friends who were writers, and they would write things, and I'd go, you know, that's not what I want. I want it to be like this, and I'd wind up changing it around. And then at a certain point, I thought, I'm just going to do it myself. And I realized, oh, that it kind of is what being a writer or storyteller is, when you have actual ideas and you want to tell that story. But I never put myself in that position. And once I committed to that, I tried to focus on how to best do that. You know, what are the ways to tell a story that I am interested in, that I respond to?
All right, well, this is going to sound like a strange question. It's a combo. When did you first realize you really could write? There's always that moment where you go, like, hey, you know, like, I got response or whatever it was. When did you first realize, all right, I might be able to make a career out of this?
I think that was sort of the beauty of it, is that I never, and still to this day, I never think of myself really as a writer. It's more like a, you know, kind of an artisan skill, where it's like, okay, I'm crafting these stories so that then I can draw them or so that they can then be movies, but I don't necessarily think of it as a skill. And I think I actually, like, that may be like something I just, like, that might be what I'm gifted in, is that I can actually write without any, you know, real thought about it, whereas the drawing is something that is, I think I'm not that gifted as an artist. I have to really work at it and focus and think, you know, try to think it through, whereas the writing comes very, very naturally to me. And so I think I was just lucky in that regard.
All right, and then last contextual question like that is, in your estimation, what makes a good story and a story worth telling?
I just think for me, I look for an interesting, compelling character or characters, and just a sort of a truthful and surprising story that that they kind of guide you through. I try to let the characters, I introduce them to a situation and I try to let them kind of fight their way out of it. And that's always the most interesting for me. I always try to keep myself surprised and not know the ending of anything I'm working on. Have some sense of the beats of it, you know, sort of the feel of the whole thing, but not really know what that ending's going to be till I get there, and to try to live it with the characters and feel the same emotion they do when I get there.
Well, that explains sometimes the organic nature of your stories then.
Yeah, and why they don't all fit together.
Well, let me ask you, so you mentioned that what makes a good story is a compelling character, but what I kind of see is that you take a character that on the surface may not seem that compelling,
right?
But there is always in your work so much truth that people are compelled, they're touched, they're moved. How important is that for you, and has it ever surprised you just how much what you do resonates with people?
Well, I don't know. I don't get a lot of like one-on-one response. You know, it's all very distant. You know, you just sort of hear people's responses. I don't have too many people who will speak to me directly about it. So it all feels sort of separate from what I'm doing. I mean, I'm really only interested in if it feels right to me, because that's the only gauge I have to know whether I'm on the right track. Mm-hmm. And if I get too much thinking about how other people respond, it's always confusing. People always laugh at the places I didn't even intend to be funny, and you know, and whenever I finish a book, the thing people mostly talk about is usually something that didn't even occur to me as being that interesting. So it's, you know, I find it's better to just put it out there and let the world deal with it.
Well, you know, it's funny you say that, because I have a friend who's like the biggest, like the most, like I've met every celebrity in the world. The fact that I know you is the biggest thing in the world to her. She's such a huge fan.
All right. I like her already.
As soon as I mentioned, like, I was going to be interviewed, she sent me the favorite page from Wilson. This is the page. Is this in the movie? And so, just curious, when you adapt things, because now this is your third adaptation,
yeah.
How faithful versus, you know, the visual medium of film, because, you know, comic panels really is a lot like storyboards. So so how much do you, you know, how do you balance that? What's your method now?
You know, with I'm pretty good about my own work of not being beholden to it. You know, it's I feel like if I was adapting another author, I would feel like, oh my God, you know, Philip Roth is going to be mad that I changed this.
Right.
You know, and it'd be very difficult. But with myself, I don't worry about, you know, insulting my own work. But and with the other movies, I definitely went very far afield from the books. But with Wilson, I tried to do that. I really went into it thinking, you know, here's a chance to do a whole different version of the story. And I kept kind of moving away from it and then always going back to the book. The book, it was the only book I've ever done where I had a whole lot of material and I pared it down over and over and over until it was just sort of this essential 80-page sequence of moments. And and it just felt really indelible in some way. And so I just, when I was writing the film, I kept going back to the book and making it closer to the book. So it's, you know, there's a lot more to the film in terms of, you know, kind of branching out from the story, but it's very much in the same sequence as the book, and it's the same guy.
What I noticed from looking at the book versus the comic, and especially that page that she loved so much, is that what you've taken is you may not do scene for scene. It may be the first part of the scene, but you'll take it somewhere else. It maintains the spirit of the character and the type of encounters he has,
right.
But it's not, you know, like you said, beholden.
Right.
And is that something that, like you said, you've always known, or over time you've kind of learned what works and doesn't work on film?
No, it's, and a lot of that is just the way the director filmed it and put it together. You know, the book is made up of 80 scenes that are almost always the same structure. You know, it's sort of this, it's like a 6-panel, 7-panel comic strip. And they almost all end with a punchline that may either be a joke or a tragic thought or something that feels like a punchline. And if you were to do that in a movie, it would just be this stultifying boom, boom,
right,
boom,
right, right.
Bataan death march of film. And so I tried not to write the film like that, and I think the editor and the director even took it further and tried to make it seem less a bunch of, you know, beats along a path. So it's that's the kind of organic stuff that happens in the process.
Now, how what are your thoughts on, because I know recently Drawn and Quartered had a Are You Wilson contest, so which was pretty funny.
No actual Wilson would ever enter that. That's the problem. they're like, I don't have a camera. What am I supposed
exactly,
to do?
Exactly. And why would I? But what are your thoughts on casting? How did you feel about when they told you Woody Harrelson was going to do it? And overall, how involved are you? Or do you just get on the same page with the director and let them go? Or do they keep you involved?
You know, with this film, I really went into it wanting to have that experience of just writing my words on a bunch stack of pages and handing it off and then going buying a ticket, really. I wanted to not see it till it was actually in the theater and have that experience of, you know, what, like seeing a movie that I couldn't even necessarily think about as my own work, you know, that's
okay.
So far along in the process. And of course, you know, I've seen it now before it was released, and I've seen it 3 or 4 times, but it was very much a hands-off experience. And the director, Craig, I met with, and I really liked him and felt connected to him. And when he told me Woody Harrelson, it was such a revelation, because it had never occurred to me, and yet it was perfect. So
absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Now, and again, this may seem like a somewhat esoteric question. It's a little more contextual, too. Human beings have been telling stories throughout history, throughout culture, every culture. What do you think the purpose of story is? Why do you think human beings need stories?
I don't know. I always look at... there's something interesting to me in the fact that when we dream in stories, and they're filled with drama, and they're all, you know, you don't have just a dream where you're sitting around doing the dishes. You have dreams where things come at you and you're forced to deal with circumstances, and it's a way of sort of processing the tensions of the day. And I that's what I'm kind of trying to capture in my comics and stories, is that sense of those experiences we have kind of filtered through this unconscious sensibility that turn them into something that, you know, helps us process our thoughts. And I'm all I can hope is that my processed thoughts resonate with other people in some way, you know, because that's really all they are.
Sure. And in terms of writing, drawing is kind of a solitary thing.
Yes, it is.
So and a number of your characters are, just let's say, a tad antisocial.
Yeah.
How much would you say you, and probably get asked this a lot, how much of yourself is in there versus things you just want to say? Because I know myself as a writer, sometimes I'm working on something, and, you know, this is the story, this is, and then somewhere along the line I go, huh, I'm writing about this, aren't I? So how much of your work is self-revelation or, you know, discovering things that you're writing about when you do it?
Well, I try to keep myself open, and I try to... The one thing I've learned in all the years is I can sort of see what my thought patterns are at any given time. I can sort of see what my thought patterns are at any given time, and I try to write things that I know I will be I'll still be engaged with whatever subject I'm writing, with whatever events come along. So right now I'm trying to, you know, I was working on a long story, a comic book that really was set in a world where Hillary Clinton would be president. You know, it's, and not necessarily that she would be mentioned, it wasn't political in any way, but that I was writing it last year, and I felt like that's going to be, you know, where my head will be at. And now I'm looking at it, and I'm like, I have to write a very different story, or I have to reinterpret this story.
Or make it science fiction now.
A dystopian hellscape, because I'm gonna be having very different thoughts, you know, in the upcoming years, and I have to be aware of that, you know, because it's, you know, we don't have a clue what's going to be happening in a year from now.
Well, if we read 1984 or any number.
Yeah, we'd be lucky if it's 1984.
Well, thank you, Dan.
Good to see you as always.
Definitely. I'm set.
You know, also, Joe, today, earlier today, I went to a Valarian thing where they showed a trailer for Valarian in 3D, and Luc Besson and Dane DeHaan came out and they introduced it, and then they took us all to lunch at the Lincoln restaurant, and they came over to each table and sat with, you know, a few of us would be at each table, and I got to interview them both and talk about Valarian. So I have an interview with Dane DeHaan and I have an interview with Luc Besson, but I'm just going to play the one question I did get to ask him. I asked him a couple, but I asked him about how, you know, when he was doing the Fifth Element, you know, you had to have elaborate special effects and opticals and you have to do some stuff in camera. And it was just a lot to doing special effects back then. But now special effects have caught up to his imagination. So he talked about that it was kind of a hell doing it. And then shortly after, he said like 6 months after he did The Fifth Element, like all these digital effects kind of, you know, came on the scene. And
he probably said, no, dude.
Exactly. That's pretty close to what he said.
It was a nightmare. And then 6 months later, you basically can have the camera on shoulder, shoot whatever you want, and the guy say, oh, I will deal with it after. And I was like, are you kidding? Why you don't say that last year? It was insane. And I always think I will venge one day. So that's my vengeance. Because The Fifth Element has 188 shots with special effect. Oh,
wow.
This one has 2,734.
Wow.
So that's the size of the vengeance.
Now, what made you want to make this film?
I don't know what else to do. I'm not good to anything else. Except cooking. No, so first, I started reading the album when I was 10. So I really know Valerian very well. But I tried to explain that to my kids, that at the time, I have 2 pages on Tuesday in a magazine. That's all I have. I have to wait Tuesday to get the magazine, go back home, finish my homework, clean the table, take the thing back, open the magazine, and you have 2 pages. And I see my kids with their,
right,
know, they go on YouTube or Google, right, they have right, like 2 billion information that they don't care.
Exactly.
And I said, are you're nuts. And at the end of the year, when you have the entire album, 2 pages by 2 pages, the Christmas present was the album. You know, you finally have the, you know, the album.
Thing, the collected, yeah.
Yeah, so it stick in your, and it was the first time we see a girl in space. A boy and a girl, like a couple, it was very new. And she's kicking ass, and wow. And she's gorgeous, you know, I was in love. My first love attempt. But the funny thing is, I never thought about doing a film about it, because it was just part of my childhood. And when I did The Fifth Element, I hired the designer from Valerian, and he worked with me for 6 months. And he's the one saying, why are you doing this stupid Fifth Element thing? Why are you don't do Valerian? You say that you like it. And I say, yeah, I like it, but you cannot do it. It's impossible. You have 2 characters and 2 billions of aliens. No, we can't.
Wow.
And so then we have to wait a long time. And I start writing like 10 years ago a little bit in case the technology will be ready. And then Avatar comes.
Mm-hmm.
And then everything is possible. Thanks to Jim.
All right, and that was Luc Besson talking about his film that's coming up later this year called Valerian.
And the new trailer drops in about 2 days.
Right, exactly. That's what I went to, the trailer event.
Now, you're not someone who likes trailers, but how did it look?
You know, well, I'll tell you what, it looks, first of all, it looks fantastic. It looks fantastic. The effects, it's like, even if the movie's no good, the effects are so immersive and fantastic. It's just fantastic. What, like, wow. Okay, wow. It's very, very French. you know, graphic novel, French comic book, especially, you know, that stuff that was very popular in the 70s and 80s and, you know, heavy metal in that whole time period, you know, with Mobius and whatnot. And, you know, it's based on a famous French novel. So it looks fantastic. Aliens, the spaceships, it's just the visuals, fantastic.
Well, it's based on a comic book by Pierre Christian and Jean-Claude.
Exactly.
It's theirs.
Well, that's what he talked about in the interview that
okay.
when he was, you know, he read it when he was 10. So he's, you know, he's always loved it, but it was impossible to do. But the thing is, what I liked about the trailer is it sets you up, but it doesn't really tell you much. And I like that because I hate, as you well know, I hate sitting through a movie waiting for what I don't know is going to happen to start happening.
Yes.
So. All right, so Chris is here now. So, Chris,
yes.
A couple films we were going to talk about. We talked about a couple films that you never saw, but now we're going to talk about a couple films that you have seen. First, Joe, I want to know what your thoughts were, because I have a lot of thoughts on Get Out, but I want to know your thoughts on Get Out.
I really liked it. I thought it was very skillfully written. I liked the fact that the way that he was able to keep the seriousness of the tale segregated from the comedy and the comic relief until he tied it all together nicely at the very end, so that he allowed the comedic moments in without impacting on the sheer terror and peril and jeopardy that was going on with the main character in the situation he was in. And I thought it was very, very well acted. And again, you know, like I've said for years, I think there really is a symbiotic relationship between comedy and horror, and that he just proved that he had the chops to do both equally as well. And I thought it was interesting. I thought it was an interesting story, too.
Chris, what were your thoughts on Get Out?
I really, really liked it a lot. Kudos to bringing a film in that was exploring the genre of horror and comedy, as Joe was saying. I really liked how he was able to weave that story. The characters were very believable for the most part. For me, I really enjoyed it. I laughed. There was a nice sized crowd that I saw it with, which was added to it. You know, so people were howling at certain parts, and you know, it has that Stepford Wives meets what's the other Stepford Wives and
Westworld.
Yeah, it has a little bit of that flavor in it. Oh, and actually, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner is the other vibe of that. But I really, really enjoyed it. It was fun to see. It also reminded me of just films I saw like 20 years ago for some weird reason, you know, because of the Stepford Wives thing and stuff like that. But I really enjoyed it. I totally recommend it, 100%. And I think the film's been doing, I think it's got some good legs from what I can see. It's finding it. It's the sleeper of this year, they're calling it, I think.
All right. Well, I wanted to know what you white boys thought of the film. So, but let me just tell you. Let me just tell you. First of all,
you got to play the race card, huh?
Well,
I'm watching
you
the OJ thing. I'm halfway through the OJ thing, all because of you.
First of all,
you're playing. The race card.
I got my bingo card up. How about you?
But first of all, is the OJ thing not pretty friggin' amazing?
Yes, it is. It's amazing. Just so many things. I forgot this and that, and it's just. I would never think, and if you wouldn't have recommended it, I really didn't want to relive all of it again, but I've been thoroughly enjoying it. And the performances, Courtney Vance is just amazing as Jerry.
What I'm talking about. I'm not even talking about that. I was talking about the documentary. You're watching the drama. I've heard that's good. I haven't even seen that.
Oh, I'm watching the drama. I didn't watch the documentary. No,
I'm talking about the documentary. Oh, my God. Oh. No, stop. Stop.
And if I can add the sixth degree of separation.
Yes.
I just watched the new Dave Chappelle comedy special.
That's
and
great.
part of his gag is that he is going to tell over the course of the evening the stories of the four times he met O.J.
Four times before. David Chappelle. I loved it. It's good to see David Chappelle back. You know,
yes.
are,
Joe and I are symbiotic once again, watching the same things, I thoroughly enjoyed it. Okay, Mike, so you want me to watch the documentary on? Okay, I'll watch that too.
No, pause this. Pause this. Go back to the documentary. Just go to the documentary. Stop watching this.
Okay.
Go to the documentary.
Do that. But you need to see. Joe,
no, I know.
I've heard
that that's very good. It won a lot of awards too.
Yeah, Joe, did you see?
I saw bits and pieces of it because it was interfering with some of my other TV watching. Hmm.
It's actually really good. I mean, John Travolta, everyone's performance is spot on. I was way amazed.
John Travolta
amazed.
Was scary.
Yes, so he is scary.
He's just very scary.
But anyway, Mike, so now you pulled the race car and Get Out.
Let me pull the race car. First of all, in my opinion, Get Out is a game changer. It's a game changer on a lot of levels, okay? And I think it will go down in history as a game changer. Okay, first, on the film level, and as an homage to horror films, absolutely. This is somebody who loves horror films. You know, there are homages to a lot of things in there. I saw The Shining. I saw a lot of things in there. And I liked it for that. And he understands horror. He understands going to the theater and sitting with an audience. Horror. He gets it. Okay. Two, I think it's an interesting time that we live in that comedians are the most, let's just say they have the most insightful view on the world. You know, we're getting the best, you know, views on the day's events from comedians, you know, not from the news, you know. So this is a time that I just think that the social relevance of comedy, I think, is an all-time high. Okay. Three, what I also like about this film is that it reminds us, or reminds me, or hopefully the world, of what horror can be. You know, horror just for horror's sake and the scares and this, and that's great and all that. And we've seen a million different horror movies and there's been tons of them. But what you forget is what can be done in horror is you can, because this is sort of a little bit of sci-fi in there too, but what can be done in horror is you can say a lot. It can be scary. It can be funny, but you can say a lot. You can talk about a lot of things. And he did. And people forget that films like Night of the Living Dead was not just a horror film. It had something to say. It was a political statement. You read any interview with George Romero? Social relevance. Most horror films, So it's a horror film with social relevance. But again, the beauty of the horror genre of comedy and science fiction is that you can talk about these things without hitting people over the head. Now, let me just tell you, okay, my perspective as a black man, that opening scene, okay, in the neighborhood, that is an everyday horror for a black person, okay, to be caught somewhere in a white neighborhood. You know, the memory, the concept of whatever level of a lynching you might want to think of, it's happened to me. I totally remember being in a white neighborhood somewhere in Queens late at night. I'm young. I'm like 20 years old. I'm looking, trying to find his friend's address. It's at night, and I hear in the background, "Nigga," like that. What? And I'm telling you, okay, this is not an uncommon thing if you're a black person that has white friends and you go to their neighborhood, okay, at night, okay, in a suburb, okay. And when he saw that, when he depicted that on screen, for me, it set the whole tone of the film, which is that everyday horror, that horror that's right there in your face that you may not be aware of, that you may not even be paying attention to. No white person really would even have to ever experience that day-to-day horror. It's just not part of life. But as a person of color. Now, what I also think is interesting about this film is that it's spoken so much that a friend of mine called me up and he's like, "Oh, you know, how come there's no love for Get Out?" And I was like, "What are you talking about?" And then I read about the hate for this film. You know, what people don't like about this film, what people have an issue with. And the fourth thing
like to know what some of those are.
I can give that out to you too. But the fourth thing that I want to say about Get Out is what I also, for me, okay, and this is, you know, not a mission, but this is something I truly believe, you know, genre, filmmaking, storytelling, you know, we've been doing it for years and years and years on film. You pick a genre on film, and it's been dominated by certain culture, okay? And that is white culture. It has been dominated. Most of the stories. I have a book from 100 greatest films of all time. There's one black film. One black film is in there. One black film. And there's Chinese films and French films. Yeah, and
what
it's
black film was in there?
It's Do the Right Thing. Okay. But the point is from Entertainment Weekly, you know.
Number 99, Do the Right Thing.
Exactly. I'm just saying. What it also reminds me, what Get Out also reminds me, and to me is an example of A, what I think is coming, okay, because and B, like, okay, wow, I want you, Joe Masiri, name me three or four black horror directors, okay? There are at least two that'll come to mind quickly, but after that, you got to struggle.
Yeah, John Singleton.
All right, you know, he's done a horror film, but I wouldn't call him a horror film director. But yes,
oh, I didn't know you say horror films. But,
horror films. Not
Ernest Dickinson.
Exactly. Okay, Ernest Dickinson. He's the easy choice.
And Spike Lee.
There it is. Okay, and if you want to, go there, you can say Eddie Murphy with Vampire in Brooklyn. Okay, but
he didn't direct.
Landis. Was that Wes Craven? That's right. Yeah, he just wrote it. Anyway, the point I'm making is, yeah. When Spike Lee did a remake of Ganja and Hess, okay? So right. I'm saying there are more, and I've interviewed a couple of them, all right? They're more. They're lesser known, obviously. But I still can count them on one hand, okay? So what does that tell you? What it tells me is that there are a lot of stories to be told from a perspective we haven't seen. Not that
that's
perspective.
Very good point.
It's an incredible point to me because there's such a wealth of it out there. That you know, I was watching another film that you said you didn't see, Chris, but you saw, Joe, Fantastic Beasts, okay, you know, and I was watching. I had to watch it because I have to talk about it tomorrow in New York One, and I missed it in the theaters, and I'm watching, and I heard mixed reviews, you know, and I was watching with Herrera, okay, and Herrera, and you know, he said something to the effect. We got into the conversation of, you know, looking for black characters in, you know, let's say Hollywood films. We all know the paucity of people of color. And I just, without thinking about it, I just said, I don't go into a film, you know, looking for that, whether it's Valerian or whatever. I don't look for that because I'm not waiting for, you know, Hollywood to offer up some role, you know. I'm looking to the time where we can make our own, you know. So I say all that to say that for me, Get Out's a game changer, and the game changer now in Hollywood is now, oh, we could talk about race, we could have black characters, and we can make money. All of a sudden, a lot of films that could have been made, should have been made, may get made. That doesn't mean they won't be crap, but there are a lot of films now. This happens in Hollywood. When something works that fits into a few different genres and has to do with people of color, all right, now we'll see more. And for me, I applaud that because I believe that Afrofuturism and all of that is going to become a huge force in the entertainment market, just like anime is. It's just something you haven't seen that's only been glimpsed at. I consider Get Out to be a glimpse of what has yet to be tapped into. That's just my opinion.
No, I agree. The
Shape of Things to Come.
The Shape of Things to Come. So
the what were the two criticisms? Because I'm just curious to see what the criticisms would have been of this film.
Of which film?
Of Get Out.
I didn't really have any criticisms. You know, my only criticisms would be the criticisms of the genre.
Or what you've been reading. You know,
you mean the criticisms against it? Oh, the criticisms against it. Well, you know, let's just say, I'm reluctant to talk about it without being able to have people weigh in on it. But let's just say there are, because the writer director, okay, is black and has a wife that is either white or half white, there are those within the black community who feel he has no right to write about such things.
You know, and at the end of the day, he can turn around and say, but it's all...
Listen, I don't think he has to say a damn thing, but that's interesting to me. But
good horror is like good science fiction. And there's a social commentary.
Absolutely. Absolutely. 100%. You know I agree with that. Thank you. So those are my thoughts. Now, Fantastic Beasts, on the other hand, what are your thoughts, Joe? What did you think of Fantastic Beasts?
Well, first of all, I really don't approve of what J.K. Rowling is doing right now. She doesn't even write
Joe books does in... not approve of J.K. No, Rowling. No, let it be known.
It's a cheat. I mean, she had such a success with Harry Potter that the play that she wrote, didn't even write the novelization of it. She published the book, she published the play. And that's what the fans fell upon. And now the whole thing was
Look at him. She didn't even.
Because she realized she doesn't have to, that the fans are so hungry for stuff. So with the Fantastic Beasts, she didn't even write a novel.
She wrote the screenplay.
And she published the screenplay.
Yay, there it is. Why not?
Where's
your multi-million dollar universe?
She has her universe set up already.
No, I said, where's yours? You can't stand in judgment of J.K. Rowling. Look,
millennials and these kids, they have... I mean, you and I...
She has her audience, Joe. These kids today,
what the hell do they know?
Remember when we would go see a movie and we would see the novelization on the shelves and they had... reputable writers doing a novel.
You mean like Jaws, Joe?
No, Jaws was based on a novel, you fool. You ignorant fool.
I'm talking about something like
Peter Benchley is spinning in his grave. Novelization! Go ahead.
Like they did Nightmare Before Christmas, the Dream Child. Nightmare on Elm Street, the Dream Child. They did a paperback book, I think Leisure or I forget the company that did it, but they did a novelization of it, and they got two horror writers, Skip and Spectre, who also wrote the screenplay to do a novel. So there was
Craig,
a book.
Skip and John Spectre. They have first names.
Well, there you go. Thank you for putting that out there. But at least there is a novel out there, you know, and it's at the end of the day. She is very good at what she does. And the fact that I sat there and I said, can I borrow this book a second? And I've looked at both the Fantastic Beasts and the Blessed Child or the Cursed Child or whatever it is, the play. And I'm reading through it and it's like, there's nothing here.
Listen to me. First of all, okay, when you create intellectual properties that become billion-dollar commodities, okay? You're in the business of world-building, okay?
Right.
Now, you can build that world. You do not have to build every structure from the ground up. You can build parks and streams and things that can just be run through. She's building a world. She's got a world she's building here. It's an empire and a world. She can just throw stuff at it. It's like, yes,
fine.
Came to my mind.
But the nice thing about reading a novel is that the author takes you on a journey and then it ignites your imagination.
Hey, I got my imagination ignited at the movies.
Maybe she didn't want to spend the time, Joe. You're asking too much.
I think the script shows it. Keep in mind,
It did not have the wonder that the Harry Potter movies had.
Keep in mind, I'm only busting your chops, Joe.
All right, so
that's your preface. You don't like what she's doing in general with her career. Now, look, what did you think of this movie?
It lacked the sense of wonder, awe, and depth of character that the Harry Potter movies had.
Was it an imaginatarium? Chris was committed to an imaginatarium
with the unicorns and the fairies.
Chris lives in an imaginatarium.
I only saw the trailer, and the trailer looks great. So there it is.
The visual effects are fine.
Oh.
Is that you, Buckwheat?
Sorry, Joe. It's an old reference.
There you go. The trailer was. I knew Buckwheat. I was there in the Buckwheat.
He was there in the Buckwheat era. Go ahead.
I know.
Yes.
I thought the visual effects were okay. I didn't like the 3D, and the creatures were the most imaginative and engaging part of the whole film. But she did do a book about the Fantastic Beasts of the world of Harry Potter, and
in between books, she did.
Yeah, that. and did like a cryptozoology book of these creatures. Mm-hmm. So they were fully fleshed out, and all the information that the animators needed was right there to bring those characters to life as opposed to the characters. And I think in some respects, and I know you haven't seen the film, but his whole world that exists in this suitcase that he carries just made him them seem like a wizarding version of Dr. Doolittle. And the world inside his case was like the whole world that he builds inside the shell of the pink snail, lunar snail, or whatever it was.
That was just a set, Joe.
No, I know, but I'm just saying.
Listen, when that's what I thought was, that's what attracted me, and I think what captured my interest. And not only that, isn't it just a metaphor for life, Joe? Shouldn't we all carry our whole world in a suitcase?
All right, listen. Can I give my review now after?
My daughter was a Harry Potter fan, loved it. I mean, she went to the movie dressed in her Harry Potter stuff, and she had a great time with it. And
dressed in her Harry Potter stuff.
Just like when you go to the Star Trek movies. And
listen, I don't do that anymore. Okay?
Yes, you do, Mike.
No, I don't.
Yes,
you
do.
I do not. You
dress up for the Star Trek. You put
you
the uniform
will be absorbed.
On.
You will be absorbed. All right, anyway.
Sit in the front row and you shout out the dialogue. You read the script beforehand. You know what they're going to say.
Yeah. That,
you go out and you find girls to dress up like a whore to bring with you.
Like a whore?
It's like a whore. That's the best line.
A whore. Not a whore.
Your name is Jim.
Anyway. Cool. I'd rather have Nova from Planet of the Apes.
You'd rather have Nova. Yes. Look at that. I taught you how to smile.
Exactly. I taught you how to smile. All right. So here's my review of Fantastic Beasts. First of all, I understood all this because Joe had railed on about J.K. Rowling before. So I was aware of this, and I knew that she wrote this as a screenplay from the ground up, and that it's a launching pad for at least another three films centering around the author of this cryptozoologist book, Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. So they kind of give an idea of, you know, all right, how this all... You know, how this book came to be and who is, you know, Newt Scamander. Now, first off, the biggest problem with the film for me is the main character, but I'll get back to that. What I thought worked about the film was the other characters. There were some interesting other characters that I cared about a lot more than the main character. Overall, I feel like Joe said, you know, there's not enough meat on the bone. She is a very imaginative author. There are a few lapses of logic in there. You know, Newt Scamander is the most irresponsible wizard there has ever been. You know, it's like he carries around something that could potentially wreak havoc on anywhere he goes, and he just kind of like, la-di-da, oh, where's my case? You know, so that's kind of a little... It's hard to have sympathy for this character. For me, and the main actor has this, for whatever reason in this film, the main thing about the character is that he has the poofy hair and that he never looks anybody in the eye. Like he throughout the film, you just see him like looking away, never looking anybody in the eye. I don't know why. Now that I've said it to you, Joe, if you ever watch it, and Chris, when you watch it, you'll be like, wow, he just keeps looking away. So I don't know what that's about. It's part of the performance.
Well, he engages the animals. He never looks at the people.
Yeah, but let's just say it does not add to you having any empathy for this character. And I feel he's the weakest of all the characters. I mean, you get his mission in life, and it's an admirable mission, but and he's this mad scientist kind of character, or like a Dr. Doolittle, as Joe said. But right. I definitely thought that the supporting actors were a lot more interesting than the main character, especially what's his name, who played the baker?
Oh, Dan Fogletta.
Dan Fogler, right? Dan Fogler. Yeah. Dan Fogler's character is by far the more interesting character compared to Newt Scamander, and I cared more about him. And whatever happened to that? I'd see another movie about that character and his misadventures than I would about Newt Scamander. So that's what hurts it the most. In terms of the overall story, yeah, they definitely felt like they stretched it out. There was not enough meat on the bone.
Right.
Whereas the Harry Potter films they're paring down a whole lot of story. This felt like you were puffing up a lot less of story.
Absolutely.
Do you agree, Joe?
Yes, I agree.
Joe concurs.
Faded away, and our love saw its final sunset. I thought we'd always be together. How could I ever suspect? But I still have the memory of your lips caressing my skin. A continuing pleasure that made me just want to dive in. I will never forget all the good times that you brought to me. Now our love is a shipwreck that's lost in the sea. Thank you. a swim. Sink a swim. Sink a swim. Sink a swim. Sink. Now it's silent. You abandoned the boat and sailed away with somebody new. Now our love is a shipwreck that's lost in the sea. Today now I'm sailing alone. There's a new horizon in view.
Closing, Joe, you had a story. You had a Life is Like Science Fiction story you wanted to share that you thought was fascinating.
Oh, yeah, Joe, what's that?
What is it? I don't even know what it is. He didn't even tell me.
Do you want me to read the one from the site or the? Well, there was a story about meet the woman who can see with her ears.
Okay. Well, then just give us all three real quick there, Joe.
All right. So the last thing 21-year-old Patty Fletcher saw before the explosion was the chemical-filled steel tank beside her suddenly blooming outward. With an alarm, she realized that the plastic hose in her hand had grown unusually hot. Then the world flashed blindingly bright.
Unusually hot.
Turned a brilliant blue, the color of flames engulfing her body. When she awoke, Pat thought she might be dreaming. The world around her was featureless and dark, as though they were lost in a gray, smoky fog. Anyway, the gist of the story is, so Pat recalls, I started getting chills up my back. What made her feel so blue was that she could tell the sound was out there, beyond the reach, yada, yada, yada. It felt like the image was real, she says. It's a fence. See, there's a gate, and there's a blackness there, like the gate is open. It was a shock. It felt like you could walk along it, and that really, really shook me up. Anyway, so apparently, this woman had this accident, and afterwards, her hearing, because of the way that her bones had been damaged when they looked at it in an MRI machine, were kind of functioning a little bit like a bat's ears, and that she was able to get depth perceptions.
Wow, so she's like Daredevil.
A little bit, yeah.
Or like a cross between Daredevil, Geordi, and the Bionic Woman.
A little bit. Maybe, yeah. Okay.
Yes.
Lindsay Wagner relives.
Lindsay Wagner plays her mom.
But the other story that was more troubling that I wanted to mention, that apparently in Tennessee and North Dakota, there is legislation that is being pushed through their legislative bodies that would make drivers immune from...
There's legislation being put through by legislative bodies?
Yes.
Immune to what?
From civil liability if you ran over a protester.
Oh, so it's legal to run over protesters?
Yes.
Oh. Any type of protester, just run them over.
Tennessee bill would make drivers
in Tennessee.
Civil liability.
Non-discriminatory protest, just drive them right over.
If they hit protesters in the street.
Well, think about that. You could tell somebody was protesting. He was protesting on my property.
No, it's got to be in the street.
Oh, okay.
This is not like, you know, that guy who, like, you know, claims he shot somebody who was on his property kind of thing.
Yeah.
If you want to protest, fine. I'm for people protesting, but not lawless riots, says Hill. We don't want anyone to be hurt, but people should not knowingly put themselves in harm's way when you've got
it's been proposed.
Yes, in North Dakota and in Tennessee.
North Dakota. Ooh.
Yep. North Dakota would legalize accidentally running over protesters.
Wow.
Wow.
You need to put that up on the Facebook page, Joe.
All right. I'll put it up.
Please put it up. And just in case you're just hearing the show for the first time, this is Night Shift, and you are tuned to listener sponsored radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York, and on the web at WBAI.org. And
they can listen to us going all the way back.
That's right. You can go to our website, lifeislikesciencefiction.com. And you can listen to, not 15, it's over 10 years, though. Lifeislikesciencefiction.com, just go there. There's Night Shift going back. You can get your daily, monthly, weekly fix, you know, hourly Night Shift fix. You could listen to Night Shift day after day after day after day for at least a month. And then you'd start to see things. Exactly. and then we control you. Exactly. Then we control you. It is. I will tell you when. I will tell you how. All right. And
that would be kind of interesting to do. Someone should just do that.
That's what Danny did in the pit. What?
Yeah. We have to have Lisa's nephew on at some point, because this this young man who's like 7 or 8 years old is don't ask me why, he is a fond believer in conspiracy theories.
Well, there it is. You know, he's clearly a child in the know.
He's a future, the future host of Night Shift. He'll be taking it on once we're done.
That's good. When we move on.
When we move on.
When we move on.
He will be carrying the torch. That
broadcast in the sky.
Yes.
The zeitgeist of radio.
So yeah, Lisa did a bad thing. She turned around and told him, oh, well, yeah, you got to sit him down in front of the TV and have him watch the zeitgeist movies.
Yes,
yeah, that'd
yes,
be great. Like, you go visit him at school, he's sitting by himself. Like,
all exactly. Put his aluminum hat on.
No kid will talk to him.
No.
So don't do it, Joe. Don't do it. So, all right. So, and the one from the Night Shift. Now, do you have that?
Yes, Idaho.
Okay. Now, let me just tell you, if you want to know about Night Shift on Facebook, you can like us, NITESHIFT on Facebook. Now, the story he's telling you is on the page.
Yes, we nice. Often post daily. This has got, okay, so there's a trigger here that says, really, really? Okay, mm-hmm. really? But this says, they got this from the AP, but it's Moscow, Idaho.
Wait. Okay. Is this the okay? Okay.
This is Mike's favorite like
there you go.
Newspaper. The Kiev Times.
No. This is actually from. Hold on. This is actually taken from KULR Channel 8.
That's right. Live from Moscow.
Moscow, Idaho.
That's right. Oh. There is a Moscow, Idaho, you know.
Oh, Moscow, Idaho in the U.S.
That's yes. right, you fool.
Oh. Not Idaho, Moscow. Not that there's
an Idaho. Oh, and what's going on? And what's happening in that town?
Idaho. Now,
that's
woman.
What's...
What?
No, I'm telling Krista.
Okay. Idaho woman says she crashed because she saw a Sasquatch.
Now, that's an original... Like, she gets out of jail free for that.
There you go. A northern Idaho woman told police she... crashed into a deer, so she hit the deer because she was
to avoid
distracted the Sasquatch in her rearview mirror. Sasquatches in the rearview mirror may be closer than they appear.
Breathalyzer results are pending.
I've done that same thing.
I avoided the Sasquatch,
I hit the deer.
I hit a deer. But I didn't.
I was avoiding the Sasquatch.
Exactly.
The woman told Benoit County Sheriff's officials that she saw a Sasquatch chasing a deer on the side of the road while driving. She says she checked one of her mirrors to get a second look at the beast, and when she looked, the deer ran in front of her.
Well, wow. There it is.
The sheriff's offices marked the incident as vehicle versus deer collision, but did not report any evidence of Bigfoot.
Well, what evidence could there be? That's right, Moscow. What evidence would there be? But again, that's a good excuse. I think she gets, you know, kudos for that excuse. Like, yeah, and I'm sorry, honey. You'll never guess. Like, where were you? Honey, you'll never guess.
Kudos.
Narrowly avoided Bigfoot. And I stood there stunned for at least an hour or two. All right.
Wow.
And the other thing that you should know that there was a bunch of scientists who hacked a human cell and reprogrammed it like a computer.
Wow.
I'll post that on the Night Shift.
Hacking the human cell. Definitely. Yeah. All right. Do you want to do the brain scanning one?
Let Chris do the brain scanning one. I'm posting this story.
Chris, are you?
No,
are you,
I can't get on. Yeah, I can't. Yeah, I can't pull up Facebook.
All right, I'll do the brain scanning.
Do it.
Okay. First of all, I love that this is happening. Okay, because here it is. Brain scanning accurately predicts how well a movie will do in theaters.
Nice.
Okay. Filmmakers have long used focus groups and test audiences to determine how best to tweak their vision for maximum crowd appeal. It makes good business sense and can increase the likelihood that you enjoy the film in the long run. Now, the science of getting moviegoers out of their homes into the theaters just got kicked into overdrive thanks to a new study that shows how neuroscience and brain scanning can actually forecast whether a movie will be a hit or a bust. Researchers at Northwestern's Kellogg School of Management, okay, just let that sink in, have developed a method for predicting how well a movie trailer will be received by an audience and thereby accurately predicting how well the film will perform in theaters. It is called...
great!
There it is. It is called the buckwheat theory. No, I'm kidding. It says, in a study...
Exactly.
In a study of 120 movie buffs, participants wore EEG brain monitors while watching a variety of film trailers, and their brainwave patterns were monitored. The researchers were able to determine how well the trailers were grabbing the attention of the viewers based on how similar the viewers' brain patterns were. The neural similarity rating tended to be a great predictor of how well the final product was received at the box office, with greater neural similarity resulting in a higher gross and more engagement. While with over a dozen film trailers in the test pool, the clip for S-Men Days of Future Past performed the best. Then the animated film Mr. Peabody and Sherman came in last place. The neural similarity ratings accurately matched the box office performance of both films. And the team says that the brainwave scanning method is at least 20% more accurate at predicting a film to be a flop or a hit than less scientific survey options.
It's interesting. You know, but again, all the factors are, who knows if they advertise the film again, does that make a difference as well, though?
You know, it's kind of, you know, exactly. There's so many factors.
There's so many factors. I mean, so you know, I think overall, whether somebody will like a product is the real, you know, the
listen
real question.
To me, listen to me. All I can say is we all remember the trailer for the original Dune. Okay.
Yeah.
It looked fantastic. That's all I can say.
But you know, the Netflix has this down now, dude, because you start watching enough things, and if you rate them, and if you want to rate them or not, but it'll start telling you, hey, if you like this, you might like this.
That's right.
And even though it'll be
following the algorithm of your choices.
Yeah, but here's where it gets really interesting.
That's a good name for an album.
What would it?
The Algorithm of Your Choices. What do you think, Joe?
No.
It's exciting.
Come on!
It's a
romantic album from a tech queen.
But it's interesting, man, because I watched a show because it was recommended, even though I knew the show was only going to be one season. And I still watched it. And it was good. And I knew that it was going to leave me hanging because it was tried for a season, basically it was cut loose. But it still was recommended through Netflix, you know, having watched a bunch of other things, and I did like it. That being
said, for me, it's the reverse. Yep. Like, because I get all these crappy horror movies, and so like when I look at it and see like it's only one star, one and a half, two stars kind of thing, and like, you know, before it hit Netflix, they've been like pounding me to watch it and review it, and then I'm like, you know, two or three times I watched them anyway, and I was like, these people know what they're talking about. I don't know why I wasted my time.
I understand. So now you trust Netflix.
That's the porno version.
Oh,
right. But I'm seeing where that's going to become the norm, like another norm. Like, see why everybody is always the Netflix, and you can just continue to watch. I mean, they have all the Star Treks on there. They have everything without commercials, so you can sit there like I do, and you can watch all the Star Treks over and over and over again. What do you want to see? You want to see Deep Space Nine, Voyager, it's the original Star Treks.
Listen,
you
if know, there's a show in there called this, there's a show in there called Surface. I think you'd like that.
What's it called?
Surface.
It was on there. I don't know if it's on there anymore.
It doesn't
surface
finish.
As
surface.
In the, a surface of a
yes, like thing? Yes, yes, surface. Yes. Just watch it all the way, binge it, and then tell me what
binge
you think.
It. Binge it. How many seasons was it?
Just one. Doesn't finish. It ends at the end of it. You'll be like, oh snap, you realize the whole first season was a setup for what was going to be a fantastic series. And
wow,
and, yeah, but it's good. It's
well, I watched a series on there. Do you see OA, Joe? Do you see OA?
You know, I don't know, it didn't grab me. I watched three episodes and then just left it.
What about Stranger Things?
Watched it all the way through, loved it.
You liked it? Loved it. You see, Mike, Stranger Things is really, you should see.
I know,
that too.
I saw the first two, three episodes, but I want to see.
And OA was good. It's just, wasn't sure. Liked it, but wasn't sure.
And I watched all of Iron Fist.
And?
Mm.
I liked it. It started off slow, but it's a more melodramatic soap opera-ish Marvel story than Daredevil or Luke Cage. Although, if I was a Marvel movie superhero as opposed to a Marvel Netflix superhero, I would want in my contract that, you know, I get to get it on with some of the ladies, because every one of the superheroes on Netflix, Luke Cage, Daredevil, now Iron Fist, they get the ladies. They get their moment in the bed. Mm. You've never seen that happen in any of the Marvel movies.
Well, that's because they're Marvel TV shows. You can do more on TV than you can do in the movies, because you got to be concerned about box office, take kids and all the PG-13. This is TV. Mm. It's on demand. Now I can put out what I want. Now I'm not liable because you said you wanted it, and it's up to you to control the stuff in your house.
There you go. If I was Tony Stark, I'd be like, you know what? Can I have a cameo on the...
Stop.
Marvel TV show, and maybe, you know,
have some sex. Listen,
have a little love.
Who knew Joe wanted to be a superhero his whole life?
No. I don't want to be no superhero.
That's the name of the album right there.
I don't want to be
no superhero, Joe Masseri. Yeah. So, listen, gentlemen.
Yes.
We're going to tell everybody how much we enjoy them listening to the show. And,
love everybody listening to the show.
They can listen to it. I got a little bit of classic Night Shift I'm throwing in the end here.
Okay.
And we'll be back next week live.
Yes.
Joe.
Yes. And maybe even streaming.
And probably streaming. There it is.
Oh, there it is.
There it is. And maybe we could do a thing. Maybe we could create like a giant Skype chat. And like we'll have a Skype camera going, and Chris will have a camera in his place going, and we'll have one in the studio, and everybody Skype's party.
You know, this is where the world's going. You know, at a certain point, no one's going to be anywhere except where they want to be.
And we can wear masks like in that Natalie Portman movie.
Actually, I have three of the masks from. Remember the movie The Strangers? They had the goat. They had the lamb, they had the bull.
No, I want to do the show as the lamb.
How much stuff do you have now?
Oh, no, listen. When he goes, you'll be at the auction. That's all I got to say.
No, I just think, Joe, you should start selling some of that stuff, because you probably have some really good stuff. You might as well start losing all of it.
No, I'm going to sell it for my daughter's college fund.
Yeah, or whatever, you know. You start selling it so you can buy that house in Seattle, Washington.
Montana.
Oh, you want to go to Montana now?
He wants to wear a cowboy hat. That's his thing.
I want to go out in the morning. I want to get eggs from the chickens and, you know.
Wow.
Joe getting eggs from the chickens. We'll do a documentary on him at one
time. Really want, no, Joe, do you really want chickens? Do you really want that?
Yeah. Nothing like a fresh egg. I mean, we grew out at our summer house. We had the chicken farm was, you know, not too far away. We get the fresh eggs. Some of them still warm kind of thing. Uh-huh.
You want to get some ducks, too, because duck eggs are pretty cool.
Yeah, but ducks can have some attitudes. Ducks go either way. They're either nice or they're obnoxious.
Yeah.
Are we? Is that why right now life seems like science fiction?
Yes.
I knew it. I knew it. Because life does seem like a Roland Emmerich film right now. It does. We're in the midst of, you know, this is it. So this is, hopefully this
and
is...
you missed the post-atomic atmosphere downtown.
I missed the post-atomic atmosphere. I should have just come to get to soak it up. You know, I like the end of the apocalyptic atmosphere. All right, I don't want to say that because it'll make me seem insensitive to human suffering. The last thing I just wanted to say about the communication is that not having it must make you realize what kind of communication really is important. Because I feel like, you know, I say I'm the odd man out because I'll be with people and you could be in the middle of dinner, middle of conversation, the phone rings, they stop what they're doing to look who's calling. And to me, it's like, I don't care who's calling. I don't care unless it's like I'm worried about some relative or something that's in a hospital or you know, a child or something. Why am I stopping what I'm doing in the middle of a conversation, middle of dinner, middle of a movie, whatever it is, to see who's calling? Why is that communication so essential? And it's one of those things that we've changed. It's sort of like every communication is essential. Did I get any emails? Did I get any texts? Did I get any posts on Facebook? It's like, what? Why is all of a sudden everything other than what you're doing in that moment so important? That's my question. Back to what you were going to say.
No, you know, it's funny because just because I don't want to be interrupted, as you say, I put my phone always on silent.
My phone is always on silent.
But the trick is...
Unless I'm home and I have...
No, but the trick is just because you put that on silent, as soon as you can, you check. You know, continuously,
that's
constantly.
What I'm saying. For what?
No, but I do it because I don't want to be interrupted. But as soon as I have a second, well.
Everybody does it. If you're running a business,
you know,
it makes sense.
I always check right in the middle of sex. Like if they're all putting in a text, I got to check right. I don't care. I got to check. I'm right in the middle of sex, I'll check, you know.
Well, many people have this.
You guys are both slapping.
Yes, we you know.
Yes, one should take a time out every once in a while.
Yes.
You're so good that you check all the time.
That is so not true.
You check all the time.
That is so not true. Anyway, Byron.
You're checking right now.
No, I'm checking the amount of time.
What is going to be very interesting over these next couple of weeks, post Sandy, is the notion of going into the holiday season. And where people, especially for Thanksgiving, the reason why we do Thanksgiving is so that we can share our bounty with the friends and family. And so it's going to be even more important this holiday season. A lot of people are going to be on.
Are you going home for Thanksgiving?
I hope to. I need to. I want to. I want to be with my family.
I understand.
So I encourage people to get to know their neighbors. If you all need help, if you need help, do not be ashamed or too humble to ask for it, because it is out there for you. Don't be frustrated when the insurance money doesn't come right away, because it's not going to come right away.
Now, I've heard rumor that they're changing like insurance rates now. All the insurance companies are changing insurance rates for like all the affected areas. Like if you want to try and get homeowners insurance or renters insurance or property insurance, all those rates are changed.
I wouldn't be
surprised. Really? Won't wait.
Meaning they're going to be higher now because we're in a climate. Climate has changed. It's like, okay, the insurance companies acknowledge climate change. They know that there's global warming, so they go, aha, you're in an area that's affected by global warming. We can charge you more. That's basically what I've heard is happening.
That's what's going to happen.
That is going to happen, clearly.
And
I got to say, the bubble, where I live here in the bubble, I think uptown is going to become a lot more attractive to people.
Perhaps so.
Come on. The money area, Wall Street. And here's one more thing I got to throw in there. Did it escape anybody's notice that Stock Exchange could not open for several days, but the world's still here? Byron, nothing happened. So, here's the question. If everything's okay without the Stock Exchange, why do we even need the Stock Exchange when there was nothing but E-Trades going on anyway? Explain that to me. Explain it to me. What's the whole ringing of the bell, the Stock Exchange? Gotta watch it. Gotta be the craziness. But it's not open and nothing changed.
Ding, 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 ding.
Hello? I'm missing something. I don't understand. Can you explain this to me?
Investor.
I want to know why. Can you, Chris? Can you help me?
Because they want to make sure their money is back up online.
What is it? It sounds like it's all a show.
It is.
It's just theater. It's theater.
It's the biggest Ponzi.
It's financial theater? You're saying the Stock Exchange is just financial theater?
It's the biggest Ponzi scheme. The
That's what I'm saying. Like, okay, no, it's not even in the news. Nobody even said anything. Yeah, stock exchange closed again. Yeah, it's flooded down there. Trades, everything. No, there's no blip. There's no economies. No countries fell. Nothing.
Yeah. Right.
Why is that?
About your money anyway.
So, like, clearly, Wall Street's just a symbol.
Basically.
If those people didn't get there.
Wall Street is a symbol, but, you know, everything is a symbol to something else. You know what I mean? In other words, everything is, that's the game.
Everything is a symbol to something else.
The stock market's running, the world will continue, you know?
Well, I think they should spend some of their money on helping to clean up what's all been lost over here.
You mean like Trump, who's going to take $5 million to edify his ego?
He should give some of that money to people. Just lost their
job. You want to know if somebody offered him $2 million if
you'd
shave his head?
Yeah, that was the owner of the Dallas Mavericks.
Did he?
I think that's hilarious.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, that's all they have to do.
I give him $2 million just to comb his hair back.
That's all they have to do with their money. See, it's a waste.
Just comb it back. I just want to see how real it is.
That's a good resource of their money.
Thank you. Wait a minute, I was in the middle of a conversation, man.
Well, I'm cutting you off. Okay. Now. Okay.
Okay.
And you can go back to it.
We've been commissioned to go back when.
That's right. You can go back after we've finished. Yes. Okay. And you are still tuned to Listener Sponsored Radio.
That's right.
WBAI 99.5 FM. And this is Night Shift. I'm Mike Sargent. I'm here with Byron Saunders.
It's my favorite show.
Chris Griffin.
Greetings, everyone.
Mr. Scott.
Hey!
Eugene Keith.
How are you?
And we're joined now by in the studio by Keith Brown.
How's it going?
Keith Brown is here. Now, I wanted to give my review of Skyfall, or at least my preview of Skyfall. Having seen the film and having interviewed, you know, the producers and Naomi. First of all, I just want to say I Casino Royale had its moments, and I understand that they were rebooting Bond. Okay, I'll give it. It was okay. It had some good moments. To me, Quantum of Solace was everything that Bond wasn't. It was generic. It felt like a Bourne ripoff. It had nothing about it that made it stand out as... Oh, that's a submarine. Anyway, so...
Sorry about that.
It's okay. The ship is calling. Captain, you want another... Admiral Nelson. Yeah, I know. And I thought in the villain, it seemed like he was fighting, a film director as a Roman Polanski. It didn't seem like it was any kind of villain at all, you know. And the plot, okay, they're gonna stop water for these people. I mean, yes, I understand. And there really were hardly any women. There was one girl for a second, and then the other girl, and it's her story. And it's Quantum of Solace. So it was very unsatisfying. And gone. They didn't even hear the Bond theme even played. They were going so far away from what Bond was, they had made it, in my opinion, generic. Okay? And to me, Bond has been branded before people even knew what branding was. Bond was branded. You knew when you were in a Bond movie, certain things happened. Yes. You know, you went for that reason. You know, it's like, he created, there wouldn't be a Bourne movie if there hadn't been a spy film industry. And all hats to Hitchcock and what he did before it. But Bond took it, like Star Wars did for science fiction or science fantasy, Bond took it, spy films to a whole new level, entered in the spy era. So, that being said, this Bond, it's everything you want a Bond movie to be. Everything. And everything you want. The theme, the music, him doing, just simple things. He does something that shows his, not just his clever, his quip, but his cleverness, his smartness that makes him Bond. There's a reason why he's Bond, because he's really clever. He can outwit his opponents. And when he does it, and it's on a big scale, and it's action. And you'd forgotten that experience. Okay? The iconic scenes. Him in a tuxedo. He's got to put one on every movie. Those are the little things. Mm-hmm. But everything that you want, okay? Everything you want in a Bond film that makes it a Bond film, all the exotic locales, beautiful women, intrigue, gadgets, spy things. Gadgets. You know, and the gadgets are at a minimum. Okay, but they serve a purpose. Okay, which always was in the film. It's like, okay, you know, it was kind of a fun thing, but how are they going to use this fun gadget? That's part of what it is to watch a Bond film. All that's back, the music. I have to say, I would never have thought of Thomas Newman as writing a score for a Bond film, but it's almost a stroke of genius.
It's excellent.
Because it's a great score, okay? Yeah. I played some of it here on the show. You'll be hearing it. And I just want to say that you will be completely satisfied. It's the best Bond film I've seen in maybe 20, 25
Get
years.
Get the fuck out of here!
And there were a few. I like Pierce Brosnan. I like Pierce Brosnan.
Never mind what that man just said.
We got it. We got it twice.
You got that bleep part?
Wasn't my fault this time.
What I said?
You know, people will be saying that while you said that, so they won't hear it.
Yeah, that's a strong statement.
Are
you looking forward to seeing the film?
Very much.
Now, and I will say this: they does something else that a Bond film hasn't done in a long time. It surprises you. There are surprises. There are plot twists where you're like, didn't expect that. They didn't. Yes, they did. There are moments like that. Moments like you know, a Bond film has those moments of pleasure. Pure, I'm in a Bond movie pleasure. You know, it is fantasy, okay? But if Batman could be grounded in reality, you could ground James Bond in reality and still make it a lot of fun. That's what I gotta say.
You gonna see it again?
Of course I'm going to see it again. What?
M and all the characters are back.
I'm just going to say everything you want is in there. That's all I'm going to say. Everything you want is in there.
I know you got the money. Pay.
All I'm going to say is everything you want is in there. You will be satisfied. You, as a matter of fact, here's the best part. When it's over, it's setting you up and you're like, oh, shoot. And then it ends. And then the thing, it says, James Bond will be back. And you are ready for the next movie. When was the last time you felt that at a Bond movie?
So you're waiting for the next one.
Exactly.
That's hot.
Let's just add to the fact that the whole film is populated now. Okay, take all of those elements, script, director, all of that, music, and it's populated with fantastic actors. Ralph Fiennes, you know, Judi Dench. You know, it's like there's a list. You just see the film. You'll be very Albert Finney. You know, these people are in it. Really good actors. Actors that like, oh yeah, wow, yeah, all right. I believe he was whatever. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, it's definitely that's my review. There it is. So here's my question. Now, Mystery Guest doesn't like James Bond, but I had the interview that I did with Barbara Broccoli and Michael G. Wilson, which I played some of at the beginning of the show. Then I have an interview with Naomi Harris, who's the new Bond girl, who I had interviewed 10 years before when she did 28 Days Later. So it's 10 years later I got to interview her again. And we watched Byron watched this documentary that's on Epix right now called Everything or Nothing. It was very good, wasn't it?
Very, very.
Mystery guest who doesn't like Bond was into it. So if you get a chance, Chris, I suggest
Bond, the backstory
that you said. Because you know how it says the beginning of every Bond movie, it says Eon Productions?
Yes.
Did you know what Eon stands for?
Yes, you told me.
Yeah, I told you. You were on the show with Keith. We told him. But Byron didn't know until he saw this documentary. Anyway, so got to speak to them. But I want to know, what is your favorite Bond film, Chris?
Mine? Oh, that's easy. It's a choice between two. It could be the one that I grew up, you know, and going to the movie theaters and watching it, seeing it.
I know the two. Right? Okay. Say that again.
And then I could talk about what I consider one of the greatest Bond films made. Okay, so it would be, obviously, Goldfinger to me is just, I could watch Goldfinger anytime and always see something different to leave it and love it. And then for me growing up, Diamonds Are Forever was just brilliant to me. I mean, I remember going to the theater, and I talked about this before when I was a kid. I went and saw it four times like a freak, and I used to sit behind people and start saying the lines from the movie like a little kid going, nah, 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 you know, like whatever the line's going to be, or this is what's going to happen. He's going to beat him up in the elevator or something, you know.
Listen to me. That was my experience seeing Wizard of Oz with Byron, just so you know.
Yeah, no, these two people, they got so annoyed, they got up and moved. They went and sat in a different part of the theater, so I got up and went and sat behind them.
You were an obnoxious child.
I was a weird kid, right?
What an obnoxious child you were. Oh, wow.
No, I didn't do that.
All right.
Sounds good.
But yes, no.
Anyway, what's your favorite Bond film? I guess Byron and.
Byron, what are your favorite Bond films?
I truly like Goldfinger.
Of course.
Wonderful, wonderful movie. And because I haven't really seen the last two.
Just your favorites, Brian. The ones you have seen, babe. You can't pick the ones you haven't seen.
That's
not fair.
Truthful. Goldfinger.
Goldfinger.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, Mr. Giss, why do you not like James Bond?
No, I was never into it because of plots. I'm not interested in those kind
How
of
many
action.
Have you seen? How many have you seen?
I haven't. It's just the idea.
Wow.
But I think now I'm watching at the DVD of Casino Royale and there's something attracting in it. No, I like the actors now. I think
probably now
I can get... But again, it's an action movie. What's... Right?
Well, you know, I mean, Bond is a lot more than an action movie.
What is
and,
it about?
Well, at its best, Bond is an adventure film.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and it's also a spy movie, so there's good espionage. So what I would say is about this new Bond movie, because it's great, it's one of the best Bond, it's definitely up there as one of the best Bonds, because it gives you everything you want in a Bond movie, which I talked about in my review earlier. But this is, it's again, it's more, it elevates the genre.
What's the name
which
of
is
it?
Skyfall. Did you hear the theme song? And the music, you know the music, you know who did the score, Chris?
Oh, yeah, you talked about it at
yeah.
the show with David Keith.
Yeah,
Thomas Newman.
Thomas Newman.
Right.
And
Thomas
it's...
Thomas Newman is without a doubt. And you're saying that
he brought so much to it. You'll get to hear here on the show. But
we love Thomas Newman. You know, we're big fans of his, and he's always been great to the show, and he's just a great composer for years. And just every, you know, it was always a movie like that. We would always like. I think I mean, one of the times you really liked the film with Al Pacino. Great place.
Scent of a Woman, great score. Yeah.
Scent of a Woman, great score.
Great score.
But I've heard some of the score already, and I'm excited to. I haven't seen the Bond film, but I'm gonna try to see it this week.
Thank you.
You're tuned to listener-sponsored radio, WBAI. I'm here with Naomi Harris, who is in the new Bond movie, Skyfall. Naomi, welcome to WBAI.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. When did you first know you wanted to be a storyteller?
I think I've always known. I've never actually wanted to do anything else. When I was younger, I don't know who gave it to me. I think it was my granddad. He gave me like a child's version of the Bible. And I memorized like sections of it. And then when anyone would come to the door, I would like force them to watch me perform it. So I was just a born performer. I just loved it. It's always what I've wanted to do. And if anyone would ask me from a very young age, I would always say I want to be an actress. And I don't know where it came from because there aren't any performers in my family at all. So I'm not really sure where it came from, but I'm really lucky because I had such a supportive mum.
I was just going to ask you, well, one of the things that has to be that you had a supportive parent.
Yeah.
How, having done what you've done now for at least 10 years, mm-hmm. and probably having met people who didn't have that, how essential and how great do you think it's been to have the career you had by having that kind of support from behind?
It's been amazing, actually, and I'm really, really grateful to my mum for two things. Not only because she was always so supportive, but she also said anything is possible if you work hard and you believe in yourself and you stick at it. And so I've always felt like, you know, people, I think in life sometimes if you tell children that things are going to be hard or they can't achieve this, then children are like sponges. They suck it up and they believe it, you know. And the thing is that my mum taught me the complete opposite. She said, you can do anything that you put your mind to. And it's so weird because I just, that's just stuck with me. I truly believe that now, you know, because it was instilled in me in such a young age. And so I'm so grateful to my mum for that. And those moments of doubt that I've had with my career, I go to my mum and I go, Mom, I'm not sure I can do that. She's always the one who's been like, yes, you can do this. She's like my biggest champion.
Does that mean you may be Queen of England one day?
Possibly, yeah. Okay. Anything is possible.
In terms of playing the kind of roles you've played, and I have to be frank, being a woman of color, mm-hmm. and there are only a limited amount of roles, mm-hmm. unless you get to a certain point where they're willing to do non-traditional casting. Mm-hmm. What have you seen happen in not just England, but in the world market in terms of how women of color are portrayed? Are you positive? Are you open? Are you hopeful? Where do you think it's headed?
I think I'm hugely positive. I'm hugely positive. And I don't think that there are a limited number of roles in the sense that I think, you know, all things are possible. Danny Boyle, for instance, when he cast me in 28 Days Later, that was complete open casting. He didn't care what ethnicity it was. He just wanted the best actress. And likewise for Bond. You know, Skyfall, Sam was searching all over the place for an actress. And he knew that he did want someone of ethnicity, but it didn't matter whether they were black or Asian or, you know, it was... So I think things are really changing. And we've got some great black... actresses of at the moment, you know, we've got Kerry Washington and Zoe Saldana and Tandy Newton over in the UK, Sofia Canedo in the UK. I mean, there are some great actresses around who are doing super well, and I'm so proud of them.
Tell me a little bit about your adventure in getting this movie. How did this first come to you? When you heard about the audition, what were your thoughts?
So basically what happened was I really credit Danny Boyle with everything because he took a risk on me with 28 Days Later when I just started and I didn't have any credits to my name. Then 10 years later, he cast me in Frankenstein at the National. And I hadn't done theatre for 10 years since leaving drama school, but he cast me in this role. And it was that role that Sam Mendes, the director of Skyfall, and also Debbie McWilliams, who casts many of the Bond movies, they came to see me in that. And that's when they said, Naomi would be right for Eve. So,
wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So it's like Danny changed my life 10 years ago and did it again 10 years later.
All right, so now you're a Bond girl, which has very different meaning than it did 20, 25, or 30 mm-hmm. years ago. Mm-hmm. Once you knew you had it, what were your thoughts? Did you have an idea of the part? Did you say, okay, I'm going to be working out like crazy to do this? Give me a little bit the next stage once you got it.
So once I had the part, Sam did say to me, you know, are you ready to do lots of action? And I kind of said at that point, I'm ready to do anything, not really knowing what was involved.
Because,
I could do that. Exactly. And it turned out that I had to do 2 months of training. I was working out 5 days a week for 2 hours a day, doing like running, circuit training, yoga. Then I was on the gun range for 3 times a week. Then I was doing stunt driving twice a week, and I was also doing combat training as well. So for 2 months, this is before the whole movie started, I was working out. Like, it was intense. It was really intense. And I am not an exerciser at all. So it was a real shock to the system. Like, I felt ill for the first 3 weeks. I thought, my gosh, I'm never going to be able to cope with this. But after those 3 weeks, I have to say, when you really push yourself like that, then afterwards you just feel amazing. You feel so alive. You feel like so much more energy. It was an amazing experience, actually. So I felt like in the end, even though it was so hard, it was a real privilege to have gone through that.
Besides perhaps your workout regimen, how do you feel this has changed you, and what did you learn about yourself having done this role now?
What did I learn about myself?
Besides knowing that you could work out like crazy.
Yeah. Well, I didn't know about learning about myself, but what I really did learn about is that I had this huge respect for people in action movies, which I never had before. I never realized just how much skill goes into it, you know, and how pressurized it is. It's a completely different way of working, you know, because if, like, the set falls down in a scene and you've got to fire a gun and what have you, you know, dealing with ammunition, for starters, is really dangerous. You have to be really careful. If the set falls down and you get your line wrong or hit the wrong mark or what have you, that's 2 hours to reset. And in Skyfall, we're dealing with the train as well, so that's half an hour to reset every time. So it's a different level of pressure, which I'm just not used to. And so I really respect action actors.
All right, what was the most difficult part about this, and what was the most rewarding?
Definitely the action stuff, as I said. The most rewarding, I think, hopefully is... Well, the most rewarding, to be honest, is being interviewed and being told just how much people love this movie, and people are saying it's the best Bond ever, you know, and they really are genuinely passionate about the movie, and that means so much, especially because I know the people involved. I know how lovely they are, like Barbara Broccoli and Michael Wilson and Sam Mendes, and so much heart has gone into this movie, and now to see them reap the rewards and to have all this praise, it's a wonderful feeling.
Now, are you ready for what could be international superstardom?
I don't think so. I went out the other day, and it was the weirdest thing, because there were these loads of, like, people waiting outside the hotel, and they all kind of mobbed me, and then I walked down the street, and there were all these paparazzi taking pictures, and I've never had that in my life. So I was like, what is going on here? So, it's a big change. It's a big change.
I guess my last question to you is, what's next? I mean, I don't know if you can top this, but what's next? Yeah.
Well, I think I have topped it. Well, no, I'm really pleased to say that I, 2 days after finishing Bond, I went off to South Africa and I played Winnie Mandela. So I'm with Idris Elba. So in Mandela Long Walk to Freedom, which I'm really excited about. It's the most challenging role that I've ever played, and I think it's going to be amazing. So, okay. Yeah. Thank you.
See, jazz, right away, is a fusion itself of different styles, of different kinds of music. The thing, most important thing, I think, is for the people out there to realize who the real innovators are, and the people who are keeping the message going with the music, the true message. But see, you know, since I moved to California, the music is a little different out here.
this part here is a shout out for a long time listener, Gene, who has been a volunteer BAI. It's about BC. It's deep regret that I announce the passing of K9 BC, who was the loving partner of Police Officer Gene Wilsia of the County of Mount Vernon Police Department. Faced with a serious, incurable medical condition, Police Officer Wilsia had to make a very difficult decision that many of us have had to face in the best interest of his partner. BC was named after Detective Bernard L. Christopher, who was killed in the line of duty in 1974 while apprehending a robbery suspect. The team of Police Officer Wilsia and K9 BC were very active in the United States Police K9 Association, in addition to being nationally certified in patrol and narcotics detection, and received several awards for their brave actions over the years. So, just wanted to give that shout out. Gene, hope you're listening.
quieres bailar conmigo toda la noche? Es un día perfecto para bailar, para gozar y para querer. ¿Quieres bailar?
Now, how long are you going to stay in New York?
I'm going to be. I have to get back. I'm going to be in for a couple of days, and then I have to get back. And then I'll probably be back down. It's an ongoing process. It's going to take. You know what's really amazing? It's like we were discussing like certain gear that we didn't pull out of there that we were going to things that you don't make decisions, and then they get ruined because you didn't make the decision or you didn't move the thing in the right place or where you placed it. And you know, whether you know, one tape machine was on wheels, so the water affected different cars versus if it didn't have, if it was on lesser, higher wheels. So it's crazy stuff like that that's just bizarre to me. But so it's an ongoing process. I'm going to have to deal with this for months and stuff because it involves containers. And we also have containers that, you know, one container wound up in the ocean kind of thing. And when I'm sure if it got retrieved, and there's a bunch of gear and you know, there's shipping containers and stuff. So there's a lot of bomb. It's gonna be a while. But anyway, to answer your question, I'll be down, and then I'll be back down again.
So you might actually appear on the show.
Live on the show, brother.
You'll be live on the show. Well, there it is, ladies and gentlemen. You have something to look forward to. Mystery guest, anything you want to say to those and to the spectral New York?
Oh, no, I'm happy that everything was back to normal. I'm just worried about, you know, New Jersey and Staten Island. It's the worst, you know.
Yes, definitely want to say something about to those.
Back to normal. It's going to take months.
Byron, anything you want to say?
It's going to be a long process for everyone out there. Not everyone specifically, but a lot of people.
I will say this much, that the reality of big government becomes a critical understanding in times of disaster. States' rights is one issue, but to have a federal authority to help all states during all disasters really supersedes any concept other than big government. That's why you need to vote. Get out there. This is your show before the day of the Tuesday, the national election.
It is election
day. So go vote, folks. Pick someone who has some compassion, who is willing to help.
You know what's surreal? I got to say, I was in a cab on like Saturday, and they're playing, you know, updates, latest news, whatever it is. And it's like, President Obama says, you know, and, you know, to the people, blah, blah, blah. He says this thing. And then they cut to Romney giving the Republican. And he says, in the first day, I will sign 5 bills. I will make new jobs. In the first day, I will do this. Yes, I will. Things will be better. It's like, he was like a robot. It sounded like the Romney robot. He's just, I'm staying on message. No matter what happened, I stay on message. I'll make more jobs.
I will sign new bills. I will do what I said.
During the debate, he used to say so often, and when I'm president, and when I'm president, oh, and when I'm president.
Of course. He read that book. He's got it in his pocket, The Secret. I see myself as president.
And then I am president. Exactly. Then he believes he's president.
He's president of his own universe. Grits?
Yeah.
Until next week, Chris. And you can visit us on the web. Yeah, well, it's time to go. And listen, you can visit us on the web, NITESHIFT on Facebook. You can like us. Please like us. And if you want to listen